lot of experts in the room, so I'm hoping we get actually more dialogue as we go through this. It's a real opportunity to flesh out some issues. And, you know, we were talking about this yesterday. You count the number of abstracts, and I think there were four posters or five. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head. On herpes, out of 190-some posters. And it's shocking to me when you think about it in terms of herpes is the most prevalent sexually transmitted infection that we have in the U.S. And then secondly, if you just look at cost impact, it's third behind HIV and HPV. And I feel like we've made some real progress around HPV because of the vaccine, and the STD field is maybe slower to embrace doing something about HPV within STD clinics. So it's not to diminish that aspect, but when you start thinking about herpes and realize how little we spend doing anything about it in our clinics, what I would really challenge us to do is, you know, we'll discuss the cases. I think they're a good thought process to think through testing, screening, how to interpret tests and some of the issues. But I'm hoping that after today, and there's a mini plenary session to go over Connie Cullum's data, we sort of reframe after this talk we have this morning the issues around herpes and try to actually work on how do we begin to do something at the national level to actually address herpes and reduce transmission, reduce the burden of disease, reduce stigma. And talking about cases is certainly one way of doing that. But it all depends in our populations about making the diagnosis. And we have tools to do that. Say over and over again that you always have to address the person coming in with genital lesions. And so I think given where we are right now, my own view is we still don't do enough addressing genital ulcerative disease, and there's not a lot of appreciation among clinicians who see herpes patients around the fact that it's incredibly common and typical lesions are not classic. So we think about classic herpes, but that's not how people usually present. So it's interesting, I'm going to New York City as part of their syphilis elimination program to talk about herpes. And I had to ask him, like, why am I coming to talk about herpes on April 1st, which is an interesting day to have a talk on herpes. And they said, because then when they talked to their clinicians, the clinician said, well, it's great. We see a little bit of syphilis, but we really see a lot of herpes. We want to know more about herpes. So I think that there's a groundswell to say we need more information. The problem is the technology is certainly there to make the diagnosis. We have to figure out better ways of implementing it. I understand there's cost issues. We'll probably get into that. But the fact that we're sort of afraid of addressing it because of time that it'll take, the concerns about the psychological impact, or the worry about false positives doesn't address the fact that most of the time we can actually figure things out. Most people do pretty well with the diagnosis. You give them the right information and tools, and we have to find ways of actually making things move forward. So that's my commercial. So in terms of when we talk about swab testing, we're referring to either culture or PCR to evaluate someone coming in with a lesion. Now, the three things that we worry about in this country are syphilis, herpes, and chancroid. And if you look at sheer numbers, you're looking at 1 million new cases of genital herpes a year, 50 million folks with genital HSV2 infection, and about 8,000 cases of syphilis a year in the U.S. Chancroid's a whole another power below that in terms of a lot different. So sheer numbers, that's what people are going to see, but it's important to never make the assumption that someone with a history of herpes coming into an STD clinic, that the lesion they have is herpes again. We still need to worry about syphilis. And conversely, I think it's very easy for us to say, well, we ruled out syphilis and never addressed what's going on, when frequently it's herpes. There are type-specific assays. The 2006 STD treatment guidelines, we took a different approach. They actually have the brand names of the test, which is very unusual for the treatment guidelines because of the confusion around type-specific tests versus non-specific tests. I think we've made some real progress, but talking to clinicians, there's still confusion out there. And they're currently, and so we'll refer to type-specific tests as TSSTs. There are five that are currently available in the U.S. Three of the five tests are laboratory-based, and two, one of them that hopefully will be available and approved this coming year, are point-of-care tests. So there's a BioKit, and there will be the Herpes Select Express assay that we're hoping gets approved this year. And just so you know what's new, this is an HSV2 IgG serology test. The hope is that it's about a 15-minute test. It's a four-step procedure. Nancy? Well, they're hoping to get CLIA waiver. So I'm saying to be correct. It's a CLIA waiver, which you know, you think about barriers to get testing done. We can get back into interpreting these things. But a lot of labs that I talk to, unless they have a complete, or a lot of clinicians, unless they have a CLIA waiver, they can't do it. Of course, we were talking about testing this morning within clinical settings, and frequently folks doing the tests within private offices are the receptionist, the nurse, not the clinician. So we have to make sure that the tests are readily available, and it's an issue about reimbursement. The nice thing is that it's one more option. It's CLIA waived. I'm hoping we can open up venues for doing more testing. We're going to have to actually, I think, be much clearer about where we think testing is appropriate and whom to screen. We don't do universal screening in most of our STD clinics, and I'm very interested to hear that Indiana's going up online soon to do that, but there are very few clinics that do that, and we need to have Dennis tell his story once it's up so people understand that the roof didn't cave in and the clinic didn't go broke, so we can actually have stories of how it can happen. My own concern when I talk to clinicians is that they worry about false positives to the point that they never get the test. So this idea that you have a don't ask, don't tell policy around herpes seems a little bit naive, and we need to, I think, provide clinicians with better tools to understand where are the vagaries of the test in terms of interpretation, if we're worried about cutoffs to be blunt, and what to do with that so it's simpler to understand. And I'm hoping that if we get that, we'll actually get the 90-96% of folks in which there's not any question about what they have or don't have, give them their information. But I do think that we are going to have to address the needs of the clinician in order to actually get to the needs of the clients and patients that we serve. And that means making clinicians comfortable with test interpretation, but also providing enough support. And it's funny, I mean, when I think about it, I think, well, syphilis is a whole lot more complicated to explain to folks, and yet we usually don't say, well, we don't want to do the test because we're not sure what to do about that. We're comfortable, I think, with screening algorithms around HIV. In fact, we're doing rapid tests, in which you still need to do confirmatory testing. That's standard. But for herpes, we've had exceptionalism around herpes testing that I think has been a real barrier for us to move forward. So again, rather than worrying about the exceptions, I think we have to figure out where are the common grounds and then provide some simple toolkits so that people understand what we're talking about. Because inevitably, and I know Terry and I talked about this last night, what we hear, people are really afraid to order tests because they're afraid that they're going to give people the wrong results. And when a lifelong chronic viral infection, that's not a trivial issue. But we can do better. And I don't think, again, that's a reason to say that we don't have tools. We've got pretty good tools now. So with that, you want me to read, Gary? And okay. So, and again, this should be kind of an open discussion. We don't care if we don't get through all the cases. It's a 25-year-old male with itchy and painful vesicles. Ulcers typical of genital herpes at the base of his penis. Has never had a history of genital lesions before that he's aware of. Has had six sex partners since becoming sexually active at age 15 and had penile vaginal intercourse with a regular partner a few days ago. So the question here is, how would you evaluate this person and what do you make of his history? Yeah. Well, no, I think a couple of other points worth making here. One, this is what people look for with general herpes. So, you know, we want people to recognize that this is not how usually general herpes presents. And that's, I think, probably obvious to people in the room from their own clinical experience. But the second thing is it's okay. If you have the classic presentation, there's a pretty high predictive value that that person actually has general herpes. So a person presenting like this, it probably is general herpes. And he's got vesicles that are clustered with ulcerations. But you still need to confirm it. So you need to have a laboratory diagnosis. That's in the treatment guidelines. And of course, the way it looks doesn't tell you anything about whether it's type 1 or type 2. And so typing is important because the natural history is very different when you counsel this person. Yes. It's the broader whole thing about treatment, diagnosis, management. I think we do forget about partners, and you know the treatment guidelines are pretty clear that folks who have a partner with general herpes should be screened for general herpes. The majority of folks find out that they have herpes after they've transmitted it to someone else, and that's the cycle we want to try to stop. So in this case, how you counsel him and how you might actually offer therapy is going to depend on his partner status and his own preference. And I really believe that this is about empowerment. If we confirm the diagnosis, which we will, and say it's general HSV2, which we don't know based on this history whether it's 1 or 2, then the counseling of controlling disease, trying to reduce transmission, will depend on whether it's HSV 1 or 2, his own personal psychological preference, his partner's status, or his partner's status, because even though we say he had sex with his regular partner, it doesn't mean he's not having sex with other people. And you'd want to be clear, too, about what we're talking about when we're talking about sex. But I think you're right. We forget frequently about the partner, and this is an issue, I think, a lot of times for private clinicians, that they have someone who is not in their care plan, who may not be in their practice, who they don't know where to refer them to, and so there's all these barriers. And I think maybe as health departments, we need to figure out better ways of targeting how we can link services or screening alternatives for folks, because it's an issue. It's been an issue all along. And of course, we don't have partner-delivered therapy for herpes, at least. Oh, yeah, no, I like this. This is good. But I want to make sure we get to everyone else, too. Yeah, I'm pretty good at stating the obvious. I usually tell people that, listen, I'm going to state the obvious, so I'm not viewing you as an idiot, you can view me as the idiot for stating the obvious, and usually go there. Forward, but how you counsel has to be separate from how you're treating right up front. And the same thing about the heart. You need a picture in the back. So there's, yeah, in the back, and we'll come up. They're homebrew. They're all homebrew, so they're commercially available, but there's not a brand PCR. Can be more difficult and certainly more expensive, and I think the important part here is that we would say you need to evaluate the lesion, but if your evaluation comes up negative, it doesn't mean it's not herpes, which again, I'm assuming everybody in this room understands. You have to understand the limits of your test and technology. So the problem is culture on this person, if you get the right area, which would be the vesicle, probably has a pretty good yield, but there's a cold chain and you know, you have to handle the specimen properly, so the yield at best is probably 75%. But if you were to get the ulcer, you're now looking at probably at best about a 50% yield based on culture. So coming up and using PCR really improves that, but I would never tell someone your test is negative by a swab test that you don't have to worry about this at all, because there are problems with any of the tests. Although with PCR, if someone coming in like this, we would expect that it should be positive. But culture, I never am comfortable with a negative culture. Cultures are helpful to cost. Yes. Sorry, get the hands going up and down. Oh, we'll get to you next, because I was pointing in the general direction. That's fine. If they have lesions, I treat. I don't know how the other treaters or providers feel, but my view is, you know, the benefit is to try to get them very early in terms of shortening the course, but if, we don't know if this is a true primary outbreak or this is recurrent, so it's hard to predict up front how long this is going to last, and certainly with primary disease, they can last for an extended period, so you want to treat. So I view the treatment courses as being pretty innocuous. I mean, the drugs are safe. We can talk about expense, but they're not that expensive, given how many people walk around with, you know, Starbucks coffee things. So put things in perspective, I would treat. And as long as they're not all completely crusted over, if they're having symptoms, I would treat them. And I would treat this person as if it's a primary outbreak, because I don't know. And that's why I think Gary's point about follow-up and seeing how he does and how quickly this heals will help you gauge whether or not you need to extend therapy or not. And again, I don't know if the treaters here should feel free to speak up from their experience. Dennis, I know, has that. it's a great opportunity because, again, the big struggle after the diagnosis itself is usually communication to partners. And as we'll get into, communication to partners is actually a good way of reducing transmission. So that's a critical part of this. It comes back to partner services and management. And I think you do have to provide people with sort of a script or something. Now, we're used to doing that around, you know, NGU and vaginitis and all this. We tell folks, we don't know if you have gonorrhea, chlamydia, but we're going to treat you presumptively in our STD clinics, and we're telling you not to have sex for the next 7 days or so. Somehow that's okay and we're comfortable with it, but this we're uncomfortable with. So we now stumble with the idea that, and again, it's, I think, herpes exceptions. We don't want to say, well, you have to tell them you might have herpes. And even the way we phrase it, I think, creates the problems that we deal back. So I'm not knocking the people who put a poster here today talking about counseling. I'm sure their data is their data, but you have to wonder about whether or not some of the issues we encounter in counseling patients are our issues that we generate and how we approach this with our patients. I really think that that's a lot to do with it. So the more I think we have these sort of templates that we should be able to get out as part of a new toolkit, I think it will help. And it's these sort of scenarios that I think are really helpful for people, clinicians, to go through in their head about what do you do with someone who comes in for the first time diagnosis of herpes. Terry. Yeah. I know, yeah, there's some statements I want to make sure we get to everyone. Like I said, I don't care if we don't get through all the cases. This is good discussion. So I'm assuming, again, people know this, but we don't do IgMs. IgMs are sort of unreliable in any herpes infection. They tend to pop up and down, and they're nonspecific. It's a big molecule that tends to glom on. So trying to say if it's type 1 or type 2 and you've got IgMs, the only real utility, from my standpoint, has to do with neonatal infection. When you're trying to sort that out, you worry about passive transfer of antibodies from mother to infant, in which case maybe with neonatal herpes you might consider IgM. That's it. So we don't order it. I think it's, I don't know how to interpret it, and it's unreliable, so there's really no place for an IgM. And I actually think we have to be very careful about going down the slippery slope of, is this, who gave this to me, and when, you know, when did I get it, and who gave it to me? Because I can't answer that, and I'm not really sure I want to, and I also usually tell people, you know, I'm not really sure that's a good idea to go there anyway, because you may find out something you don't want to know to begin with, but the truth of the matter is, most people have herpes and come in with this, so it's usually not primary, and they usually have gotten it from someone who did not know that they had it, or if they did, they didn't realize they were infectious. So it's very complicated, and I think we need to deal with the person and help them through it. But if this gets into an issue about fidelity and who gave this to me, and that, I think, again, it's not a reason not to make the diagnosis, and but you have to realize that that comes up. And again, Dennis, being you deal with a lot of the psychosocial issues around this, I don't know if you get any pearls and Terry.
Thank you.
But I do think it's important to tell people that they should tell their partner. It can be very empowering because, again, there's this whole shame thing about having a discussion. And if we give people, I think, a few facts and tools about how to do that, and even a little brief role play, you know, you can make this much more palatable. The unknown factor is the problem that creates all the anxiety, and I think creates a lot of the backlash that we get around testing and diagnosis and management. There were a couple other statements or questions. Well, I think your opinions, I'd be very interested in hearing how folks handle this. I mean, I think that's a discussion to begin. Yeah, go ahead. Well, no, I think you can get a lot cheaper test than that. Well, I think we do a pretty good job of providing lousy health care, so I'm always interested in how do we improve it. I mean, I don't need to tell someone that, you know, don't order the test because you can't afford it. My view is we should set the standard, and then obviously people are going to have to decide how much they either can or will be able to pay for it. But this is a diagnostic workup, so billing, you can get reimbursed if there's a billable member or something like this. And a lot of folks really do want to know, and I worry about hanging people out for 8 to 12 weeks without saying, you know, the idea that, well, it probably is herpes, we'll see in 3 months, is this really nebulous blob. So for that reason alone, my own preference would be do the test now, because likely this person's already positive, and you have to sort of set the stage that if it comes back negative again, this could be a new infection, so we'll have to walk through this and deal with it that way. I'd be curious for folks who actually do a lot of stuff in the private sector, how many folks tell you that they can't afford any diagnostic tests when they come in with this? So we've got a lot of hands, so we'll, in the back, we'll come over this way. Our question. It can happen within weeks, but the problem is that it's a slow, it depends on the test, it depends on what your cutoffs are, and this becomes an issue. So we spent a lot of time talking about, in terms of focus, their cutoffs, and you realize that with incident infection, you can have people that are positive, but I would call them in sort of this area that we still need to sort of deal with, the 0.9 or 1 to 3, 3.5. That person with this coming in, if they fell in that area, the question is this someone who's seroconverting, or are they not infected? And you have to sort of take this into consideration and sort it out. And there are other ways of doing that. You can do a second test. You can repeat the test downstream. You can do avidity assays to try to sort out whether or not you think this is an early infection or not. But it gets more complicated, and I think we still need simpler tools for doing it. But it generally will take several weeks, but if you're going to go down that route, I'd probably want to push people out far enough that we're not saying, well, there's a 70% chance that you're positive and a 30% chance you haven't developed antibodies. So we're usually talking about 8 to 12 weeks post-developing a lesion. I mean, from an STD clinic standpoint, we deal with this all the time, again, with syphilis, where you have someone comes in with an ulcer, and if their dark field, which very few of us now have anymore, is negative, you wouldn't tell them they don't have syphilis, and if you order a trust or an RPR and it's negative, you wouldn't tell them they don't have syphilis. You would begin to work through, treat appropriately, and move on, make sure you're counseling about their partners, get them in for reevaluation. So we have a framework within STD clinics where we're already sort of deal with that and recognize windows. HIV, there are windows that we're grappling with around, you know, is a negative test negative? Does this person have acute HIV or not, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of questions on this. No, go ahead, we'll let you go and then we'll move to the purple woman. Diagnostic workup, so I'm not aware of that being an issue. My experience is not anybody else. It's a billable service and they'll pay for it. Right, but the problem is that the long-term consequences of dealing with this is going to cost not make the right diagnosis, not management. it's going to cost money downstream. And this person, say if they actually have a new infection, is at particularly high risk for transmission over the next 6 months or a year. Higher rates of shedding, higher rates of recurrences. And so I worry sometimes, and I'm not saying you're saying this, that the focus on the cost of the diagnostic workup sort of is in a bubble that doesn't address all the downstream costs that that occur if this person keeps coming in two or three times with outbreaks or lesions, or transmits herpes to one or two partners, or acquires HIV because they didn't realize that they were particularly high risk over this short period of time. So we need, I think, better tools and maybe some modeling to help us actually reframe, again, the cost of a diagnostic workup to say we're not spending $300, and a guy who all of us would consider to be herpes based on this, and that's probably not good use of resources, because that's what you'll hear, and we'll hear it today. It will come up in Connie's session that if it's not connected, if we can't show that we have any impact on HIV acquisition, then why bother with this? And that sort of ignores the fact that it still is associated from an epidemiologic standpoint, and that just knowing the diagnosis actually has an impact on reducing your risk of transmitting herpes and acquiring HIV. But I think, you know, what I'm hoping too is that as we push technology and that we may be able to reduce the cost and certainly make it more feasible to do this, but there's no federal dollars going into testing programs for herpes. And that bothers me when we have someone like this who comes in and it really is up to the local level to come up with resources. And there's competing interests. And we haven't really had good models to say this individual is something we need to really address right now, whether we have any impact on HIV, and we're dependent on a vaccine, or we're dependent, or try to ignore the fact that he's at particularly high risk. I mean, the epidemiologic data is overwhelming, and yet we continue to ignore the fact that we have tools right now that will help us to address this, and we can have some impact. And I'll say it at the 2 o'clock thing, you know, we've had 4 randomized clinical trials about STD interventions that were sort of either mass interventions, or in the case of Connie's study, suppression, and only one of them showed any benefit in terms of HIV acquisition. Yet we don't say in terms of bacterial STDs after RACAI, we didn't say, well, we're not going to treat any bacterial STDs because it didn't show any impact. And yet I worry that that's the story we hear all along with herpes, and it's sort of like, how many times do we have to say we need to move things forward? It was a very specific question that was addressed by one study, and for whatever reason that is still being sorted out, it didn't show an impact. But that doesn't mean we should ignore everything that's out there to do something about it right now. And again, I think we can do this relatively cheaply. But we need to reduce the cost, lower the barriers, and at least set some peg marks about who we're going to go after from a diagnostic standpoint and counseling and provide those resources. And it may be an STD clinic. We'll keep going on this, and I'll turn it over to Gary. That's interesting. Sharon keeps raising her hand, so. Yeah, no, I think it's a reasonable. No, I think you're right, though. In this case, if you were to do an HSV-1, the problem is you don't know how to interpret a negative or a positive serology for HSV-1 in this case. I mean, you could say, well, if it's positive, he has it, but you don't know what he's got in terms of his lesion is due to HSV-1. And if it's negative, you don't know whether or not he has incident infection and then we'll seroconvert. So I think it's a reasonable thing to say we'll do a swab test and we can either do HSV-2 serology now or we can infer that. I would tend to do it now, and then the HSV-1 is if you don't wind up with an answer, you still have to sort it out. But there are different approaches, and I think you have to have that sort of discussion maybe as a template. It confuses people if you come in and don't have your mind up about how you want to approach it. So I think this is something you're going to have to be comfortable with. We don't have great guidelines because you're going to have a lot of opinions, and usually the more opinions you have, that means that the less information we have on what's the best approach. And I don't know, Terry, you might want to comment your experience. Great point.
So that means if the patient tells you on the lateral side of the tongue, he has ulcer. So you say to the patient, that's not what I mean. That's after his ulcers. Ulcers are things that are on, usually within the vermilion border, but occasionally on polyparasite skin, on the nose,
maybe we'll handle one more question because at the rate we're going, we'll get to case two, and that'll be it, which again is okay, but it sort of amuses me. But you know what it suggests, though, is a real need to actually have these sorts of discussions because it generates a lot of questions, and that's my point is that if we're having a hard time and asking all these questions and you are the experts, you understand the conundrum we have in the private sector for folks who aren't dealing with herpes. I mean, I think about sex and STDs all day long. Like you don't, right? No, actually I don't, but it's all the time.
hardly ever move into the field. I think that's a fair statement.
My concern is that I've taken plenty of sexual histories in my lifetime. I always believe the patient, never believe the patient, which is that I don't know if what I'm asking is being understood or what they're telling me is necessarily how I view reality. Not that they're lying to me, but that we may have different perspectives about what sex is, who's a partner, and all that. So when you start getting into this thing, it's interesting to me that I've seen cases in which they sort of conveniently forgot to mention that they've had 4 partners in the last month that weren't their regular partner, and all I heard was that, I didn't have anyone else, so who is this? And so I think we have to mention it, but I try not to get into this thing, because really, I want to deal with the infection and try to prevent disease in all of its aspects, including all of the psychosocial issues. Right, no, that was what he was addressing, Terry. It makes me nervous, and in an STD program, I really don't want to go down that path. And I think in a private practice, and I think the type of clients that you see, Terry, it's a little bit different scenario. But in the clinics, I think we really want to follow. I think the models that actually work pretty well for chlamydia, in particular, that you treat presumptively, that you counsel them about informing their partner right now that they're being evaluated. The partner should go in and get evaluated, maybe. That you make sure that they understand that they should be abstaining or using barrier methods, whatever. In this case, we would say abstaining until they clear up, and that you want them to come back in with questions. And I think we can give them tools, websites, CD-ROMs, pamphlets that are specifically going to address here's the things either to think through or questions you might have. So we're not overloading them, because it really is an overload. You give someone the diagnosis and a pill and send them on their way that they might have a lifelong infection. One quick comment, and I'm going to turn it back over to Gary so we can actually get the case too. Right, but I think that means we...
Relatively complete opinions about this issue, finding
Yeah, but I do want to comment, though, on that, because I think what we have to do is come up with new models. And the problem we've gotten into are that STD clinics have always viewed themselves as one-stop shopping. You come in and you leave. And the problem with that is it doesn't address the changing epidemiology and emphasis as we learn new diseases. So, you know, we didn't do pap smears in STD clinics because we said, well, they all have HPV, but we were getting high-risk populations, and we don't know how to follow up with them, so we don't have them come in. We've sort of bridged that a little bit with rapid testing around HIV because we were worried about getting to them, giving them the information. I think for instance, vaccine-preventable STDs, a lot of STD programs have a hard time doing it because they say, well, they only come in once. How are we going to get the second, third, or fourth dose? And I would argue, let's figure it out. Try to come up with something. It doesn't mean you have to come back into the STD clinic. We could look at referrals or counseling centers or have times like we do for non-traditional HIV counseling sites to come back in away from the spectrum of sitting in the waiting room to go back in again, which is in and of itself can be pretty traumatic. And I understand there are constraints. So all politics are local. I think all STD control is local. You have to look at your resources, your space, and all that. But we need to be more creative to say, look, we can do better with this. And I hear what you're saying, but I don't think we can do all this in one visit. And that, I think, has been the big barrier around herpes, is that people say, well, if we can't do it all at once, then we're not going to do it. But it's with the EDs. The EDs, emergency rooms, have not done HIV testing primarily because they didn't want to be saddled with follow-up. But they do that for blood cultures, urine cultures, TB, go down the list. So why was HIV different? And my argument is still the same with herpes. All right, I'm going to let you read it.
All right, I'll read it.
The shooting gallery is there. No, 21-year-old female, recurrent dysuria and vaginitis. In the old days, she would have been in a vaginitis clinic, but also if a closely taken history were done, she would probably have dysuria as well. Three treated episodes of vaginitis in the past 8 months. Bacterial urine cultures negative. Tests for BV, trich, and yeast are negative as well. Test for chlamydia is negative. Probably the patient ended up getting treated because she's now been back a number of times. She got treated for chlamydia because it was simple and relatively expensive. I'm not advocating for that, but I'm also reflecting what I see in charts. Has had antibacterial therapy for suspected bacterial UTIs at least once, and has been treated with metronidazole and antifungals for suspected vaginitis. This patient's been looked at syndromically and been treated syndromically. And this is not atypical. And this is not uncommon that this is done. It may not be, I don't think it's a terrific diagnosis, but often it is. What do you think of this case? Can we throw this out? Joan, what do you think? Right. So you would do what? So let's say this patient came to you, they were referred by their clinician who no longer decided that she doesn't like to practice anymore, and you're now seeing her in, she's what, 21, so old to you for adolescent medicine, but she's gotten older with you, and she's now your patient. What would you do on referral? Better go ahead fast. You know, we decided to skip case three as case three was a redundant case. So Peter? You wonder, oh, I'll read. 16-year-old male, has been sexually active for 6 months. One female sexual partner, first genital herpes lesion on the head of the penis. Most of his sexual activity has been receptive oral sex with occasional penile vaginal intercourse. What would you do? Dennis, what would you do? I'm going to call on people. If I don't know your name, you're lucky. Dennis, what would you do? Yeah. say it was 4 months from now and you had introduced serology in your clinics, what else would you do? Culture? Culture comes back negative. All right, culture's negative. He's back in 10 days. You treated him, I'm assuming. Maybe you come to sit with that. Well, the Iowa person at one session said they had a lot of syphilis rising. All right, so thank you. Thank you. Have to be. Treated them, they took their medication, you dispensed it. Their lesions are pretty much healed. Just going to case 5, but that's okay. Thank you. did tell him about, he's now broken up with his girlfriend because despite his best efforts, she freaked out and said adieu and moved on to the next girlfriend. And Terry. Of course, there's many other versions of this, but let's just ask Dennis, what would he tell that young man who's now 17 says to him, well, what does this all mean in terms of what I can do and what people can do to me and et cetera, et cetera, or however elderly say to 17-year-olds and what is well, I'm not sure I would share that with the patient, but the answer is we do not know. And you know, Dennis said it more elegantly, but you know, we just don't know, and there's uncertainty here. Clinicians aren't that comfortable. Yeah.
probably relatively, you know, I think that the word is probably relatively small, but we can't give you any guarantees. So in Atlanta in 2010, we will have the women having sex with women's slides because I think that's an extremely good point. But I think what your observation is what widely felt around the country. It's common, and that's why the counseling issue of what to say thereafter becomes an issue. Would you repeat that, Peter? I'm not sure everybody. Oh, yeah, we can pass. Okay, that's fair. How about somebody from this side? Okay, woman with blonde hair, I almost see. So you recommend testing the partner. He asks you before he's willing to even discuss that, what's the likelihood that his partner has, you know, got this infection from him? And what do you say? Well, this is an exact case, actually. The patient said to me, what's the chance that she got it from me? And I said, wait, I thought you just told me you hadn't had intercourse yet. Which means it's important to listen to the history. And that's right. And he wants to have the dialogue with the clinician because that's a lot easier than having it with the patient, and with the partner. One would assume it would be positive if the history has any meaning here, and one would offer his partner or suggest that his partner have a. If she's already positive for two, we're not really talking about much of an adjustment. And if she's not, then you have a discordant couple and there's issues with suppression, etc. So the patient says, well, now it's 3 years later, and she was HSV-2 positive as he was, and comes back and says, well, I don't know, every time we have intercourse every few weeks, and we have a lot of intercourse on that particular day, and you know, 5 days later she has an outbreak. What does that mean? Well, it means they're probably the vigorous intercourse, or intercourse is an initiator of reactivation. In her case, it's clinical. It has nothing to do with transmitting infection back and forth. So one has to look at the context. Rarely, but it could evolve. I think offering the opportunity for the patient to come in, even if you're not their clinician, but to have a joint discussion, a conjoint discussion, is very useful, but often doesn't occur for a variety of reasons. And but I think you're... Well, I think that less than 1% of our visits in L.A. County, we once looked at this question, involved having two people, you know, in the same counseling session. But, you know, that's not a small, one in 100 is not zero. But I think each sector thinks the other sector is more likely to have both people in the room. And so I'm not sure. You come from the public sector or the private sector? Rehearsing the discussion. Okay, let's... But getting some, you know, it's in a data-free world, people can have as high an anxiety level as they want. But it might help looking at some of the, there have been posters over the last few years around people, you know, sort of asking the patients, if the test was available, you know, at this price, for free, what do you think your peers would do? Your neighbors, you know, would they be rushing in, et cetera? You know, getting some basic information, then you can make some... I think people who have done this find that that's not the case. Or let's say the people who come on Friday have serology. Run public STD programs, you get these phone calls on Friday at 4 about what tests to order. And obviously we're not taking the clinician out of the picture by saying, in my opinion, that we've really shortchanged ourselves by not having some type of better guidance around this question. And not in a silo type way. Well, what do? The patient comes in, they tell you they've been at risk, they've done some things they shouldn't have, with people they didn't know all that well. What do? What tests do you order? And I think that the STD online, is there anybody here from the ISIS? Well, you know, they're going to be dealing with this issue because they have protocols that they're developing when people say certain answers to certain questions as to what tests they're going to recommend of the five that they're offering online, you know, as a way to go to the lab with an online order from Dr. Klausner, and who's the STD director in San Francisco, is working with them. And I think that we need to do some shortchanging ourselves by saying nothing about this issue, except you should have an HIV test once in your life, which is kind of a mess, right? That's been said recently. You know, we've avoided HIV so far. I mean, a lot of these patients, if you look at that protocol, should have had an HIV test. Not all of them, but some of them, perhaps. Question? Well, it's important. And other people would say, you know, it's local epidemiology, which is enough to drive the average clinician nuts. to hear that statement. What does that mean? You know, in their part of town, in the town as a whole, who's the epidemiologist? Have they ever seen a patient? And, you know, these are the kinds of things that go through clinicians' minds. So I just say, I didn't say this is easy to deal with, but you know, we need to deal with this sooner than later, and it's been going on for years with no resolution. You know, we can stand here and beat up the clinicians. Anyway, thank you for coming.